Visioneers, Episode 4, Success and Danger.
Well, the Visioneers continue. In the last tape, the venture was launched, and we saw the Visioneers going out and doing extraordinary things. And the theme is picked up that they're on to a global stage, and they're going to address the challenges that was shown to us at the beginning in the Earthscape. Now, as we proceed, there's a whole string of action pieces in different parts of the world, and we'll share these with you now. Des, would you start in Russia?
Yes, well, what we're really doing now is extending the pieces that began before, and you might remember that, Jerry, you described the Russian scene a little bit, where we had Bill Bates and Daniel Thomas rowing across the lake and arriving to meet their Russian compatriots, or the people who are going to become their Russian compatriots. These are rather interesting characters. There's this tall giant of a man with a red beard, Vladimir Rostov, and his one of his friends there is Anna Borodina, who's built more like a Russian tank and charges around everywhere. And then there's Boris Dubrovka, who is more the serious, lean and hungry-looking person. And they come together and they have this marvelous exchange and feast upon red caviar and Russian beer. And then Vladimir Rostov brings out the vodka, and Daniel Thomas gets rather loquacious, and it's all rather stirring and exciting, until finally in the end Bill Bates sums it up by saying that we're looking to Russia to find its way out of its serious problems that it's in and be a leader in the world in the spirit of visioneering. And that's the kind of a theme that comes out of that piece. And from there now we move on to another sort of a stirring idea for a future in another part of the world which hasn't always had a pleasant association in the minds of people. So, Jerry, why don't you pick this one up?
Well, this is one of my favorite pieces, Des. Mohammed Hussein is in Beijing, and he meets with Lin Yuan and this ancient Chinese gentleman. And I like to read to you this old man's vision for China, because it's so unusual. Lin Yuan and Mohammed Hussein are ushered into one of the smaller reception rooms of the Great Hall. Even so, it's huge by conventional standards, with 10-meter-high ceilings, large oil paintings and tapestries on the wall, and a deep-piled, intricately woven carpet on the floor. Seated alone in a high-backed plain chair by the window is a very old Chinese gentleman. He's dressed in a simple, well-cut Mao jacket and pants. His hand, as he extends it to visitors, is trembling and fragile as a leaf. Wrinkled, parched skin is stretched over his ancient face. Eyes that have seen the sun rise more than 30,000 times over turbulent Chinese history survey them quietly. This is Zhao Xie Yuan, a former vice president of many portfolios, now retired from official duties but well-respected among China's ruling elite, and a benevolent supporter of Lin Yuan among many hundreds of senior secretaries of the central administration. Well, this old man doesn't speak English, but he does have an extraordinary vision which is translated, and I'll share that with you. He says, I want you to look out there on the square. That's Tiananmen Square, the square that has this history of horror in the minds of people alive today. He says, look out at that square and see 200,000 Chinese citizens of all ages, but more young than old, and many of them schoolchildren, just like we see the ones out there today. All of these people have come together for a celebration. They're smiling and moving easily. They've brought their lunch because they intend to make a day of it. Families are sharing food with each other and with other families they don't know. And there are street musicians and acrobats and clowns. People are laughing. The sun is shining. There's not one soldier or sign of authority or force among the whole 200,000 people. And in the center of the square, there's a platform with banners on it saying, the people share their vision. And there, speaker after speaker for hours are telling what they have done in their districts, in their factories, in their schools. telling what they've done to build a cooperative vision, what they've already achieved and what they intend to achieve. Sometimes, instead of speaking, they put on little dramatizations and they tell their story that way, sometimes in song and dance, and the loudspeakers are booming out the messages all around the square so everyone can hear, and the television cameras of the world are there, and it's all being shown to the world as the way China is caring for its people and helping them to invent the future. And at the end of the day, there's singing and dancing in the square and fireworks and food for everyone and more than enough to go around because people are sharing everything as they celebrate their vision. This is what an old man sees, and it will happen soon. I have been waiting in my heart to see it come forward. Now both of you, referring to Lin Yuan and Muhammad Hussein, now both of you are here. Sent from somewhere to make it happen. We must sit together now and plan how to begin.
Yes, and from the mysterious place of China, we now move to another mysterious country, India. And here we have Indira Murthy and Carmen Santander coming down to an ashram in a lovely valley called Ventagiri. And it's from this piece that we begin to see a deep spiritual message appearing in the story. As they come in, they join a crowd of about 1,000 people chanting as the sun is setting and the night sounds are beginning. And in coming out into the midst of these people, they see a magnificent figure, a tall man in a saffron-colored robe, striding out, moving among the people. And this is the great spiritual leader, Baba Satyananda, and he's going to play a central role in the story from here on in. And after he greets Carmen and Indira, then he asks them to meet with him later in the evening. And when they do meet later, he starts to speak with them about truth. And this is what he says. Truth is foremost among the qualities that men and women must embrace if they're to build the visions you would have them create for the future. The world has lost its way in the search for truth, which was first revealed in the scriptures of the Upanishads almost 3,000 years ago. People were considered ready then to receive the truth, or at least to know the path to the truth in preparation for this later time when other knowledge might lead them away. And so it has happened. Humanity has embraced the knowledge of science, but it's not truth. It's only the outer part of truth, the thinnest part of the outer husk of knowledge. Within is the kernel, but that remains unknown and unknowable to those who search only with the senses and the intellect. I've come to lead the world back to the search for truth. Others have come before me, each one showing the way, but their teachings have not been heard deeply enough, or they've been set aside, or what is worse, reinterpreted. So now we have nations arming themselves for mortal combat, just as they always have done, but now with weapons too horrible and destructive to be imagined, and impoverishing themselves to do it. And what is the basis of it? The base is the false sense of truth. The truth of the world is that happiness comes from the pursuit of pleasure through acquiring material goods. But that's not the truth of the universe. The truth of the universe is that happiness comes from loving. It begins with loving God, who is the flow of the universe, from whence all life derives, and understanding that God is in us, because we are part of the spirit of the universe, and that we are first and foremost spirit, and only secondarily body. Spirit housed in body, we call it Atma, and knowing that because everyone is Atma, that we're all of one being, one spirit, and that one spirit is God. If people were to understand, truly understand that they are one with God because we're all drawn from the ocean of the universal Atma, which is God, then we would know that we're all one and that in loving God we love ourselves and our neighbors, and we wouldn't seek to harm or ill-use any of our fellow human beings, because we are, all of us, manifestations of one divine spirit. That's the truth I've come to teach, and it's the truth that underlies what you call visioneering. Once people understand that we're all one in God, and that it's the same God for all, then they can build the shared visions of a world moving forward in harmony and peace.
Well, now we are beginning to see the link between the Louis Valdez message of spirit and the words of Baba Satchinanda. And from there, we go to Africa, and we see that this spirit is linked as well. And the scene opens with a bus coming up the dusty road, and the bus has got on its plain black lettering on its side, Government of Urawi, and then another sign hand-painted above the windshield, Visioneers Express. And it's creating all this dust as it comes along, and it finally rolls up noisily in front of the house. And then it stops, and it reminds Carl Ibsen of a circus. But the people begin to pour out, the people with colors, the reds and the golds and the purples and the greens and the flowing robes and the uniforms and the medals and the scarves and the straw hats. But above all, we've got the smiling faces, all shades of chocolate brown, beaming at Carl and Mutsando, and the two men come down from the porch, shaking hands, embracing and greeting one another with jokes and laughter. And What we experience here is a wonderful festival of color, of sound, of rich human fellowship. And Carl calls out the Visioneers Express, though this looks like a lightly group of travelers. And by this time, they're all pretty hungry. It's noon and it's time to eat. And a meal has been prepared on the lawn. And the color of the vegetables, the red watermelons, the radishes, the peppers, the tomatoes, the avocados, the yellow corn on the cob, the pawpaws, the bananas, the whole grain bread, and the whole thing is such as a sign of life. And of course, Mutsando has not spared this day to feed his guests well. And as everyone has eaten and drunk and feels relaxed, he begins to talk to the group and says, "My friends, this is a wonderful day for us," and he thanks them for coming. He says, "Today we are turning the tide of history. Here in this place, we symbolically begin the journey back from our troubled past to a prosperous future." And he's prepared a symbol for them, and he waves to the boys who are standing in the background, carrying several cardboard boxes, and they run to the tables and give to each person a small blue flag with a large white circle in the middle of it and a bold white V inside the circle. It's a flag of the Visioneers, first seen in the Visioneering Room when Teresa's children ran through the streets of Naples. And now it's handed out on this sunny day in Africa as the official symbols of the Visioneers in that continent. And Mutsando says, "Take your flags and from them make thousands more to wave proudly for those who are going to work on all fronts." And he is really talking to ordinary people, to the people who can do small projects in a positive way. And you know, Africa has always been considered the continent of despair. But now when you see the fellowship, when you see the color, when you see the basic humanity, we have to think of Africa as a continent of hope. And with visioneering, carrying the banner of hope for ordinary Africans.
Yeah, and that's such a terribly important message. So with all of these vignettes, we've got the link now into what is to follow. And that's really picked up by a news broadcast, which is reported in the book coming out of the BBC. And here's the BBC announcer. "On the international scene, we have a rather extraordinary report from a UNESCO conference in Paris. UNESCO is the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization. Speaking at the opening of its general conference in Paris this morning, Prince Rupert of Wittgenstein made an unexpected departure from his prepared text to tell the delegates of the existence of a group of people calling themselves visioneers. He then ran a short video presented by one of the visioneers, Father Louis Valdez, a Roman Catholic priest in Chile. This presentation was made last evening, Chilean time, via satellite and picked up as an unscheduled broadcast on several South American networks. Our sources in South America say that it's already producing a lot of reaction in political circles in several countries, though there's considerable confusion as to its origin and purpose. In the meantime, an apparently related development has been reported from Harare in southern Africa. In an official communique, President Mutsando from that country announced that a group of people, whom he is calling visionaries, will be leading a series of community-based development projects in more than 40 countries in the sub-Sahara portion of that continent. An interview with President Mutsando will be included in our item on this topic tomorrow evening.
Well, now the scene dissolves into a radio announcer on CZFT-FM in Toronto, Canada, and you couldn't have a greater contrast with a BBC announcer. He says something like, wow, we have a wild one going here, boys and girls. That's the third phone call we've received from someone who was at the Marathon Miracle Show in Vancouver on the weekend. They're all reporting a weird, and I mean really weird, conclusion to the program. Apparently, the strange gal, calling herself Teresa, somehow got onto the stage and led everyone singing Amazing Grace and then told them she wanted them to be visionaries. Well, now, that's a new one on me. I've heard of engineers and musketeers, but visionaries? Anyway, she apparently brought the house down and sent everyone marching this new song of the visionaries out into the streets. So I'm going to see now if there's anyone out there who has watched that broadcast. And call now and let us know, were you at the show in Vancouver last night? Oh my God, my buttons lit up immediately. And then he gets his first call from Brett, who describes the situation is speaking with a rather awe in his voice. And then begins to try a version of the visionaries, which comes out as a kind of squeaky teenage sound, but the spirit is there. And then he said, you should see the guys here in the control room marching up and down. He said, that could be a big hit. What happened after that? And again, he continues to be cynical. Now you're going to change the world, of course. But he says, we're all confused. And but when we
Who's confused? The announcer or Brett or
no, the young teenagers in Vancouver were confused. And then they saw Sally. Remember her? She's a pen pal of Nicholas Andropov. And she was with Teresa, and she was standing on the Terry Fox statue right outside BC Place Stadium and reminding everyone about how Terry was helping to find a cure for cancer by just going out and running with his artificial leg and cancer and all until people paid attention. Well, Sally said it could be like that with the visionaries too, and she called us the new kids of the world, and she told us to tell everyone about what happened in Vancouver and to call the radio stations and get things started. And then Brett says, and she told us to leave our number, and can I leave my number? And of course he does. And immediately the announcer takes another call, and this time it's from Carolyn. And she wasn't there, but she tells about a project that has taken off at school the next day, and they've got a visioneering club organized, and they're going to start by describing the kind of future they want, and she wants to leave her telephone number. And it keeps going on and on in that way.
So it sounds like the young people of the world are really picking up on the spirit of visioneering, and that Teresa has really had an impact.
Well, it certainly did in Vancouver, Canada, and they're trying to tell the world about it.
Okay, well, now we move on to get another set of characters coming onto the stage, and this is the American team. Now, you'll remember one of the original visionaries was Bill Bates, who's a newspaper man from Los Angeles, and he's gathered around him a team, and they meet with Mark Venture, the leader of the group, in Bill's studios in Los Angeles. And the other members of the American team are, first of all, Diane Koplitz, who's an academic and a lecturer and an author. And she has a particular perspective that the kind of aggressive, male-dominated society that we've known for the last several thousand years wasn't necessarily always in place in the world, and that indeed, if you look at the anthropological evidence of pre-cultures, you can see that what we have now is something that was essentially invented and replaced a more partnership culture of earlier times. And another member of the team is George Walker, who's a businessman, and he has a particular perspective that what we need in the world is this spirit of creative learning and creative imagination, and it's that kind of thing that will have more impact on business than all of the analytical systems that you could ever possibly invent. And then there's Senator Wilfred Brown, who's a human rights spokesman from North Carolina, and also Julia McCarthy, the owner of a network of television stations in the eastern United States. And finally, Arthur Rheingold, who's a rather flamboyant film producer from Los Angeles. And it's Arthur who hits on the idea that what they should do is make a film called The Visioneers and get that underway. And they're in the middle of this really animated discussion about the various possibilities when suddenly someone rushes in and says that Louis Valdez is on the air again. And so they all dash out to look at a TV monitor. And there, sure enough, is Louis again, this time speaking in Spanish as before, but with English subtitles running across. So his technology is improving a little bit as he gets into this second broadcast. And I'll read these subtitles to you. This is our home. It sits here, blue and fragile. Everywhere it's being attacked by men who should know better. Nowhere is it more serious than in our own rainforests. He moves to a map of South America and sweeps his hand over the vast equatorial tracts of that continent. Here, for the blind hope of a shaky future, men destroy God's creation and a life force to the world. For the few pesos they can earn from scrawny cattle and struggling crops, until the soil gives out and all that man has created is a desert where God had planted a garden. The backdrop fades, and the camera zooms in slowly on the face of Louis Valdez. Mark Venture catches his breath. A dry taste leaps to his mouth. In an instant, he recognizes in the lines and worn face the agony he once had seen as a young man in a painting of the dying cross, Christ on the cross at Calvary. The flash of recognition sears through his brain as he tries to follow the words on the screen. Who profits from such madness? Not the Indian who loses his forest home, not the farmer who remains poor, not the earth which suffers a mortal wound, only the developers and the banks who lend the money and take the interest and officials who arrange the deal. My friends, it is time for the people to take back their heritage and their dignity and build the future that they wish to have. Visioneers are gathering in your community. Find them. Join them. Learn how to build the future together. I must go now. I will speak to you again on Sunday evening. At this time, it will be a wider broadcast. Many more stations are listening, here in South America and also around the world. I will give you details, tell you where you can go, what you can do, to take the power of your life back into your own hands. Goodbye, and God bless you.
Phew. Wow. That's really has a lot of power. And because it does, that power can be dangerous. Now we have the scene set for a potential conflict for Louis Valdez in South America. Remember those soldiers? Now we see them again. And I'd like, Des, would you read that little vignette?
A thick, pungent smoke haze fills the tiny bar in the fishing village of Lascano in northern Chile. Besides the three soldiers in uniform, only a handful of other patrons sit at the tables. Behind the bar, a squat little man with balding head leans against the counter, watching a small television set hanging from the ceiling. No one else pays attention to the television program, which is barely audible above the noisy conversation of the few but highly vocal patrons. One of the soldiers comes to the bar to order more drinks.
Hey, Pedro, he says to the bartender. What do you say? The same again, eh?
He glances up at the television set.
What bullshit are you watching here, eh?
Then he catches his breath, grabs the edge of the counter and squints through his alcohol-dazed eyes at the face of Louis Valdez on the television screen.
Jesus Christ, he exclaims. Hey, Captain,
he's waving his arms and shouting loud enough to catch the attention of everyone in the bar.
Look here, it's that shithead priest we told to piss off. Look now, here he is on the fucking television.
A chair crashes back as the other two soldiers stumble over to the bar. So, you little holy bastard. The words strain through the captain's clenched teeth.
It's you, is it?
He turns to his two companions.
That's who we got the message about since he started to broadcast his drivel last Sunday. To think we could have squashed him then. But now we've got him. I'm going to nail him up to his own miserable church.
You know that priest, eh? The bartender, Pietro, has interrupted. My wife, she heard him last Sunday. There's been a lot of talk about it in the village. Look, see there? Hear what he's saying? He's going to broadcast to the world again next Sunday. Louis Valdez has signed off, and the face of a news reporter has come on the screen. He says that no one seems to know much about Louis Valdez or where he's broadcasting from. Do you know him, then? The bartender asks again. Is he here in Chile? The captain leans across the bar and presses his face close to the man's ear. The alcohol slur has left his voice, and it cuts like a steel knife edge in the thick, acrid air.
Listen, bartender, listen good, he says. You don't ask questions, and you don't say anything to anyone about what you just heard. Do you understand me, bartender?
Without looking further at the three soldiers, Pietro nods and turns his attention to polishing the glasses on the bar with a dirty beer-stained towel. The captain moves towards the door.
I'm going to call headquarters, he says to the others. You stay here and listen and tell me what else is said.
The captain straightens up, glances around the room, where the other patrons suddenly resume their conversations, a little quieter than before. He walks across the room and out into the crisp evening air.
Next, we see and hear the plotting of Louis Valdez's extermination by telephone between Santiago in Chile and Bogota in Colombia. The name of a mysterious El Condor is mentioned. The one who is giving the orders far in the background. The captain and his men are to proceed to the mission to stop Valdez before he makes another broadcast. Now we see Louis Valdez praying just before that broadcast. Could you read that, Des, and give us a picture of what that looks like?
Heavenly Father, I am here simply as your servant, Louis Valdez, priest and sinner, full of love in my heart for my Savior, and troubled in spirit for what the world has made of his loving sacrifice. We have heard but not listened. We have preached but not empowered. We have seen but closed our eyes. And we come now to this turning point in time, aching with the burden of our own willfulness, inflicting our own tortured cravings on the gentle loveliness of our world, which you gave to us for safekeeping. I am not blameless in this, my Father. None of us are. But I seek now with your help to find the words to touch the hearts and minds of enough who will listen and then say, yes, we must change. We must turn away from what we have seen only with the limited vision of our conscious thinking, without reaching deep within to hear your voice. It's time now for me, my Father, to do what I can. May I serve you well in this, and may I love in my heart as you have loved, for the beauty of the world, for the loveliness of the unselfish spirit, and for the forgiveness of those who may wish me harm. In all this, I pray to you, my God, my Savior, my Redeemer, and my one steadfast hope for all that yet can be. He continues to kneel and pray silently in his heart as the darkness outside gathers, as the minutes tick away, as he waits for George Cardinal to come and tell him it is time.
Now we get quick dramatic scenes shifting between the soldiers on the road on their mission of death, and Louis Valdez preparing his message of love and peace.
100 kilometers away, three men hunched over the hot engine of their stationary jeep cursed loudly at the futility of their repeated efforts to get it started and continue on their way. The captain and his two soldiers have taken off their uniforms and replaced them with leather jackets and dungarees. They look like roughneck hunters out for the kill. Powerful semi-automatic rifles are thrown carelessly in the back of the jeep. Their efforts at disguise have not extended to the vehicle. They had planned to park the military jeep a mile away from the village and the mission and cut through the forest on foot for the remaining distance. After killing Valdez, they could then return to the jeep, resume their military roles, and arrive officially to investigate the incident. It was a simple, crude plan formed by simple, crude minds. Now, however, it's coming apart. The jeep has been badly overheating for the last hour on the rough roads. Now it has stopped completely. They're losing valuable time while they wait for it to cool. To bolster their zeal for the mission, two large bottles of cheap whiskey have already been dispatched. The third is half finished. Alcohol combined with frustration and fear of failure has made them aggressive and violent. The captain storms around the jeep, kicking every wheel, abusing road, vehicle, and occupants with a flood of invective and crudity remarkable even by his standards. Finally, their despairing efforts to get started again bear fruit. The engine fires into life, and after a half hour's delay, they clamber into the jeep and head off on their terrible assignment.
And then we get back to Luis and George Cardinal.
The mountain air is crisp and sharp, and the stars stand out like zircons in the dark, moonless sky. Luis Valdez puts his hand on George Cardinal's arm. "Look up there, George," he says. "Look there. Have you ever seen such a sky? The good Lord has sent 100 trillion fireflies to light the heavens tonight for the safe passage of our words. Soon they'll be dancing on one of those smallest lights, the satellites sent by man to encircle the world. Oh, this could be such a wonderful universe if we could just take the evil out of it." "We will, good friend," says George. "Tonight, with the world listening, you take another step. Now we must go in. It's 15 minutes to time." "Yes, I'm ready. Let's go."
Inside the house, the preparation for the transmission is done. The whole back end of the building has become a studio. The set remains simple and cramped with a few visuals added. The lighting is stronger and a second miniaturized camera has been added that can be moved around to catch best angles. The other camera is fixed on set. Two assistants double as camera operators and technicians, leaving George Cardinal free to direct and monitor the production. Luis Valdez goes to the set. He is wearing a simple white cassock. His face is composed and serene. He settles himself beside the blue and white globe of the world that he shares as the dominant visual. He smiles at everyone and nods that he's ready. George Cardinal counts down the seconds. A technician brings up the background music. The camera focuses on a simple text, the same in English and in Spanish, to announce the broadcast to a waiting world. Luis Valdez. Vision. The signal goes out to the satellite. Technicians around the world scramble to bring it in as audiences on every continent in every time zone curiously wait to see what all this is about.
20 kilometers away, Luis Valdez's would-be assassins drive recklessly along the last stretch of the rough and twisting mountain road that leads up to the mission. Knowing already that he has failed in his assignment to silence the priest before the broadcast, the captain has abandoned all thought of caution. "Aye!" he shrieks into the wind as he sees the hour come and go on his watch. "Faster, you useless motherfucker!" he swears at the driver. "What the shit are you doing? You're dead, you bastard, you hear me? You're a dead motherfucking bastard! Faster! Don't you know the time, asshole? They're out there watching. The whole fucking world is out there watching the shithead priest, and you drive like your head is up your ass. Dead! We're all dead! We could have stopped him. We had the chance. We were the only ones who knew. We could have retired rich for life. Don't you see? This was El Condo business. No one fucks up with El Condo. We're dead. All of us are dead." "Well, we can still stop him." This comes from the third soldier in the back seat, leaning forward, shouting into the wind, gripping hard to the seat against the bone crunching, bouncing of the jeep. "We'll be there in 15 minutes. What can he say in 15 minutes? And then he's gone. Psst, snuffed out. Off the air. Forever. Goodbye, priest."
Maybe he hasn't started yet, adds the soldier doing the driving, struggling hard with the steering wheel and gears as he drives the vehicle mercilessly over rocks as big as footballs and in and out of half-meter-deep potholes. How could a stupid priest up there know what time it is? Shut your face and drive, bellows the captain. He's not so stupid that he hasn't done this before, but we'll stop him before he's done. If I'm dead, then he's dead, the sniveling little Jesus turd. The jeep roars on into the night, its headlights bouncing like the crazed eyes of a lunatic stumbling in the dark. The lights of the village come into view, very faint, and above them, fainter still, the one flickering light at the mission. The road straightens a little. The driver pushes the accelerator to the floor. The jeep leaps forward with a surge of power. Too late, they see the huge pine tree fallen down across the road. With a sickening crash, the jeep plows headlong into a heavy truck. The fan blades tear a screaming gouge into the radiator, shooting spouts of boiling water into the air. The occupants are flung about like corks. The captain catapults over the windshield and lands heavily among the branches of the pine tree. The roaring of the wind, the racing of the engine, both are gone. The silence settles back upon the scene as quickly as it was shattered. Darkness rushes in, and all trace of the mishap disappears, save for two twin beams of light stabbing upwards from the headlamps and the low moaning of the captain among the branches of the pine tree.